It was called the Friendly Gathering Music Festival. That's F-R-E-N-D-L-Y, because as those really cool hippie founders said, there's no I in friend. So Friendly Gathering, F-R-E-N-D-L-Y. The 2 years that I made the long road trip up to northern Vermont to attend Friendly were really some of the coolest experiences of my life. Unlike other music festivals, Friendly Gathering was pretty small. It's just two large stages on the side of a mountain, and then one smaller stage under a tent, with only a few thousand people in attendance. And it was very much focused on community and activities in addition to just listening to music, which we did a lot of as well. It was held at a ski resort in the summertime, and so most of us camped on the side of the mountain together. And it was really a hippie's dream, and I must confess, I'm a bit of a hippie at heart. We had 3 days full of jam bands and open mic sessions and morning yoga classes. There were even activities like a silent disco where you put on headphones and everyone's sort of listening to the same music and dancing together, and yet it's totally silent outside. It's a very weird experience. And there was even flower crown braiding classes. And so I chose to sort of unleash my inner free spirit, and I partook of almost everything that I could there except all the drugs and the free love that was going around. And even things that were foreign or uncomfortable or a bit weird to me at first, they became either interesting experiences or funny stories. And occasionally they became opportunities to contemplate a new facet of the incredibly complex nature of humanity and human emotions and relationships. Now, of course, it wasn't just a philosophical experience or field trip. I was there to have fun. I was there to enjoy good music and to eat good food and make lots of new friends, many for just an hour, some for a whole day or two, and even one or two that I kept in touch with after the party was over and recognized again the next year. And I also felt really a strong compulsion, and one of the reasons I started going was viewing it as sort of a mission field, if you will. I'm not saying that I went with any preset evangelistic agenda. I wasn't going to proselytize or get on any soapboxes. But I was just hoping and praying for opportunities to discuss faith with anyone who was interested to hear. And I really had no idea what to expect, but I quickly learned that even though there was a heavy appreciation of spirituality everywhere you went here, and everything was spiritual in one way or another, well, being a Christian was suspect in most people's eyes, to put it lightly. It was one of the few times in my life where I've felt strongly in the minority as a Christian, and when I was in a place where being Christian actually had a very negative connotation for most people. And even though I went hoping that it would be sort of a mission field, again, I didn't bring any agenda with me. I didn't discuss faith unless it came up naturally. I just sort of did the incarnational ministry kind of thing, for those familiar with the term. And it was interesting, after I was able to share what I believed with a bunch of burned out hippies around the campfire on my second night there, I earned the nickname, much to my chagrin, Preacher Man. But it became a term of respect and endearment, rather than the mistrust that they held when they first heard that me say they followed Jesus. And sure enough, showing up next year, seeing a few people from across the hill, hearing them shout, Preacher Man! People I hadn't seen for a year still remembered that conversation. Now, Friendly is interesting for those reasons, but I also sharing it here because it wasn't just a hippie paradise, though. It was really sort of a Taoist utopia, very similar to the one that we read about in chapter 80 of the Tao Te Ching. Honestly, never before, not even in church settings, have I experienced an environment where literally everyone was just so ready to embrace new people. And not just metaphorically, but often literally too, just giving out the classic hippie free hugs. I've never been in such a diverse place where everyone was just giving off nothing but positive vibes to everyone around them, whether, you know, regardless of their age or their race, gender, sexuality, religious beliefs, and so on. There was just sort of good vibes is the only way I know how to put it. Everyone was so focused on just enjoying the present moment, not stressing about things outside our control, being together with the people that were right in front of us. And this became very clear my first time there. It actually poured buckets. It was raining nonstop the entire first 2 days that I was at the festival. And so for the first couple hours or so, there was kind of just this general misery and disappointment. We came up here for this music festival. We're in tents, and it's pouring rain. But it was like suddenly something clicked on a couple hours into it. And it was like everyone kind of realized together, well, it's going to keep raining, but it's not going to stop this party. And we all pretty much realized that once you're soaked to the bone, you really can't get any wetter. And dancing and listening to music barefoot in the mud is actually pretty fun. And so one by one, the umbrellas were put away, toasts were made, and the music continued. And this kind of go-with-the-flow little episode captured something about the heart of the Tao Te Ching that was just so freeing and so exciting. Now, sadly, experiences like Friendly are not real life. And as far as I can tell, it's been canceled for the future. They haven't posted any updates in about 2 years now. It's not sustainable to live like you're camped on the side of a mountain at a music festival with no obligations. But even though this isn't quote-unquote real life, it taught me a lot about people and life. I have no doubt that, just like with people anywhere in the world, a lot of the smiles and the laughter and the joy that I witnessed were just external, or at least they were covering up intense hurt and pain. This you'll find anywhere. But I also know that I saw a lot of authentic joy and authentic love for people and love for life in a way that I've never encountered anywhere before. The counterculture that I saw at Friendly made me rethink a lot of cultural idols, toxic ways of thinking that I take for granted because they're just part of my background, part of my culture. And it definitely made me rethink how easy it is to judge people, which is something I almost never saw happen. No, in the 2 years that I went there. So why am I sharing all this about Friendly Gathering? Well, just like that music festival, the utopian society that Lao Tzu writes about in Chapter 80 is not, quote-unquote, real life. It's not sustainable. It would never work as a real country. But I think also, just like that music festival, there are layers of cultural critique that, if we can have the ears to hear them, can make us rethink a lot of our cultural idols and toxic ways of thinking. Friendly Gathering taught me things about my faith that I had never realized before, because truth can come in surprising ways sometimes. And so I hope that today we will experience that also as we hear together of Lao Tzu's own version of what we might call friendly society in Chapter 80 of the Tao Te Ching, which is that ancient book of Chinese wisdom and spirituality that didn't draw me away from a Christ-centered faith, but actually helped me hold on to it. Hi, my name is Corey Farr, and this is A Christian Reads the Tao Te Ching. We're on episode 65. I realized that introduction was quite a bit longer than normal, but I really wanted to share that story. It's not a commentary on this chapter, but I think it definitely will open our eyes to how we're going to approach the chapter today. If you have not listened to this show before, though, essentially what we're doing is working through this 81-chapter little book, short chapters, very ancient book that I discovered a few years ago and has really helped teach me a lot of things just about sort of general life and mental health, but also have seen many surprising parallels to my faith and my life as a Jesus follower. It's not a theology book. It's not a religious text, despite popular misconception. But if you're curious to know more about what exactly we're doing here, I highly recommend you go back to episode 1 and check that out. And honestly, it's probably best to listen through the series. You can pick and choose as you go, but there are definitely concepts that we've built upon throughout the last 2.5 years together. You can also go on over and check out my blog at coreyfarr.com. There is a blog series that follows the first few dozen episodes of the podcast. If you're more of a reader, you could spend some time there just to get caught up on the main idea, at least reading the first couple posts. And the introduction post is one of the first articles listed on the blog in the featured post section. But anyway, enough of an introduction. Today we're going to look at chapter 80, which, as I already said, envisions a sort of utopian society. And so we'll spend the first section of the episode talking about minimalism and living a simple life, which lies at the heart of Lao Tzu's vision here. And then we'll turn the coin over and we'll look at sort of the unspoken words here, which is the heavy cultural critique that is latent within this chapter. Because Lao Tzu's dream world is pretty much the opposite of, as I said before, the real world. And in the last section, I'll totally switch gears and I'm just going to read a few extended passages from two commentators that I think sort of clarify some misconceptions about this chapter and what is the real point of it. And is it realistic or not? And is it opposed to human growth and exploration and adventure or not? So that might be an interesting sort of footnote to the episode. But anyway, to get started, I'm going to read from both Jiafu Feng and Stephen Mitchell's translations back to back so we can compare. And I just want to add a quick side note before I read through. You're going to hear the phrase, men in this simplistic utopian society, men return to the knotting of rope in place of writing. And so obviously I had no idea what that meant at first. And so to clarify, apparently there was an ancient Chinese way of recording numbers and debts and sums and other important information through tying specific knots. I'm not sure how it worked, but that's what I was able to find out. And according to Derek Lin, this is sort of a general metaphor for simple solutions, which he says are often the most effective and reliable solutions. So anyway, let's hear from that chapter now before we dive right in. A small country has fewer people, though there are machines that can work 10 to 100 times faster than man. They are not needed. The people take death seriously and do not travel far. Though they have boats and carriages, no one uses them. Though they have armor and weapons, no one displays them. Men return to the knotting of rope in place of riding. Their food is plain and good. Their clothes fine but simple. Their homes secure. They are happy in their ways. Though they live within sight of their neighbors, and crowing cocks and barking dogs are heard across the way, yet they leave each other in peace as they grow old and die. Now from Stephen Mitchell. If a country is governed wisely, its inhabitants will be content. They enjoy the labor of their hands and don't waste time inventing labor-saving machines. Since they dearly love their homes, they aren't interested in travel. There may be a few wagons and boats, but these don't go anywhere. There may be an arsenal of weapons, but nobody ever uses them. People enjoy their food, take pleasure in being with their families, spend weekends working in their gardens, delight in the doings of the neighborhood. And even though the next country is so close that people can hear its roosters crowing and its dogs barking, they are content to die of old age without ever having gone to see it. As Oliver Benjamin says in his commentary, the penultimate chapter of the Tao Te Ching is perhaps the most strikingly lovely in the entire book. Here we have Lao Tzu kind of laying out his own mini, very mini manifesto of the perfect utopian society. It's his vision. And like so much of Taoist philosophy, we're dealing here in the world of ideals. And if we let our guard rise up and tell us that all the ways that this thing or that is totally impossible, then we're going to miss the point and lose any chance that we have to benefit from the vision laid out here. Lao Tzu's sort of 6th century BC minimalism actually rings true with much of what the modern minimalist movement is saying today. And again, Benjamin illuminates this in his commentary and points out the potential future direction of this movement if it isn't destined to burn out altogether. I think it's a very interesting commentary. He says, as many advocates of quote-unquote simple living these days will tell you, we actually don't require that much to be happy. The small house or tiny house movement, permaculture, co-ops, robotics automation, the rise of digital nomadism, and co-working spaces all point to the possibility that future generations might live in a manner quite different than we do now. Just as quality of life improved dramatically after the kinks were worked out of the industrial age, we too may be on the verge of a sort of simplified and technologically aided era hallmarked by an emphasis on mental comfort and development over that of mere materialism. On the other hand, we might also end up destroying civilization and reverting back to a Paleolithic sort of lifestyle. Interesting words. Personally, minimalism has always had a great appeal for me. And there's many reasons why. I like to keep my life as simple as possible. But I know that it's because of the single most influential book on my life was Shane Claiborne's book called The Irresistible Revolution. I used to always joke with my church friends and my students that, yes, I know I'm supposed to say the Bible was the most important and influential book in my life, but honestly, if it wasn't for my encounter with Claiborne's words as a 16-year-old just recently recommitting my life to try to figure out what this whole faith thing was about, then honestly, I would have stopped reading the Bible a long time ago if it wasn't for the way that he helped me see faith. Claiborne shined light on the radical and liberating and counter-political and counter-cultural teachings of Jesus that opened my eyes to a new way of understanding just what he was all about. And for those unfamiliar with the book, to give the very briefest summary that really just barely does justice to the book, Shane writes about his experience founding what he called a new monastic community in the slums of Philadelphia. Again, to oversimplify, this community was called the Simple Way. And to put it in a way that might have negative connotations, it was essentially a Christian commune. But it was within the city, living in a couple of houses with a few facilities as well, again, in the slums of Philadelphia. It wasn't an isolated or sequestered commune. It was a group of people doing life, sharing life together to see the kingdom of God brought about in very practical ways for an underprivileged community. The members shared their financial resources in sort of a common purse in an attempt to live out Acts 2. They served the community in many ways. They lived incredibly minimalistic and eco-friendly lives. Shane Claiborne is well known for even hand-making all of his own clothes in the most simplistic style possible. And to summarize it like this can make this sound creepy or dangerous or ridiculous or weird or just absurd. And so I really highly recommend checking out the book before you make a judgment. I think it is well worth reading. And it's so well written. Shane shares story after story of these miraculous ways that God worked through their incarnational ministry. And it was founded on principles of nonviolence and radical unrestrained love for the least of these. Anyway, I'm saying this to say that Claiborne's minimalism inspired me, and his words first opened my eyes to the fact that nonviolence and minimalism that were inherent in Jesus' life and teachings are really a big part of the reason that I still passionately hold the views today, that I hold today. I dreamed of being like Claiborne, of making my own clothes, living in a common purse community where nobody owned the finances. I fantasized, actually, as a junior and senior in high school about packing up a few things and then just showing up on the doorsteps of the Simple Way in Philadelphia to live there. Now, my life took a lot of unexpected turns, and those dreams never materialized, but many of those principles have stuck with me. I've often lost sight of some of them, but they have stuck with me. Materialism, I believe firmly, is a cultural sickness. and chasing after money is absolutely pointless, and the selfish disregard for the least of these is totally against the teachings of Christ. And these are some of my ideals. I think they're actually quite easy ideals to agree with. Trust me, I do not always, or maybe even majority of the time, successfully live out these principles, but they're sort of essential, I feel, to who I am and what I believe. Interestingly enough, they also match up incredibly well with the ideals of the Tao Te Ching. The more that we can strip ourselves and our lives of glamour and glitz, the flashing lights and deafening sounds that the Tao Te Ching talks about, the more we can remove the incessant busy work that we love to fill our lives with, the more then that we can abide in the present moment and truly live the life that has been given to us. We can truly abide in and then inhabit our physical and cultural spaces rather than just finding ourselves randomly placed there. And this is what I love about Oliver Benjamin's commentary on this chapter. He says, perhaps the most obvious aspect of this imaginary utopia is its emphasis on abiding rather than achievement. By maximizing fortitude and minimizing want, a comfortable surplus can be created which will effectively protect against the unknown. After all, it's only when we compulsively leverage ourselves against the future through borrowing and insisting on growth for growth's sake, that we then open ourselves to all sorts of potentials for disaster. Instead of consumption and projection being the yardsticks by which we measure our strength, this chapter suggests that we consider contentment and protection instead. Benjamin here just hints at the really heavy cultural critique that is latent within this chapter, the unspoken flip side of the coin behind Lao Tzu's words, which is what we're going to now look at. And so first, as we begin to look at this cultural side, this critique side, I'm going to read from Joseph Owl's translation, which calls out the idea of expansion and colonization, colonialism. And then we'll hear from John Brown Jr.'s translation, which focuses on industrialization, overdevelopment, and sort of, again, as Benjamin called it, the insistence on growth for growth's sake. So let's go ahead and hear from those now. A large nation with a large population always sets out to explore for new lands and new resources. They forge weapons and conquer others. So a large population creates conquest and suffering at home and abroad. Now, John Brown Jr. Nations, corporations, and other institutions have become centralized and hierarchical. In amassing too much power, they have become rigid and reckless toward humanity. Evolving technology continues to augment human abilities. Yet these technological advances do not necessarily address humanity's struggles. Frequently, they are appropriated by and reinforce the logic of capitalism, molding potential tools of liberation into tools of enslavement. The desire for power and control obscures the contentment of simplicity. Unchecked growth is blind and values wealth over life. Seek the changes that favor sustainability. Now, these two translations, which very clearly are more paraphrased than translation, speak for themselves. Please note, this is not a critique of capitalism, nor is it a support of capitalism. This episode's not even close to wanting to engage in the current polarized discourse over economic and political issues in the U.S., which has become more of a battleground against people than an actual ideological discussion. But still, these versions speak so much for themselves that I really find it challenging to add a whole lot to them. And I'd highly recommend you just skip back and listen to them again and maybe just stop the episode there, because they give enough to think about. But here are my thoughts. I think I think here that Jesus's attitude towards authority is very comparable with what Bronze translation or paraphrase says. This becomes really clear when we think of the way that Jesus spoke about the religious establishment, what one historical biblical scholar called the religious industrial complex, which was centered around the temple in Jerusalem, which was not only a religious, but also functioned as an economic and sort of quasi-governmental institution. If you're interested in that idea at all, I won't go into it here, but there is one of my most popular articles on my blog was called Clearing the Temple Courts, What Jesus Did About Systemic Injustice. And it goes into this concept of the temple as also an economic institution, an oppressive one, and the religious industrial complex. If you're interested in reading it, it is one of the very first, it might be the first article on the blog in sort of the featured articles section. And there is a link to the blog, again, in the show notes. But we're not going to focus on that today. We're going to focus on Jesus' words directly, which are just as powerful. He said, Jesus said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those in high positions act as tyrants over them. It must not be like that among you. On the contrary, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Think about how well this blends with Bronze version of chapter 80, which says, again, nations, corporations, and other institutions have become centralized and hierarchical. In amassing too much power, they have become rigid and reckless toward humanity. And he goes on to critique those institutions in pursuit of a simpler life. Braun also criticizes the insatiable technological development that many times, while it's ostensibly making us more free and creative and connected than ever before in history, it's actually enslaving us. I had a conversation a couple days ago with one of my patrons, and he told me about author Cal Newport, who I'd never heard of before, but sounds very interesting. I'm looking forward to check him out. And apparently he has a book called Digital Minimalism. And again, I'm extremely interested in reading it because I think it probably resonates with a lot of this version of the Tao Te Ching. And so I'll let you know more about that when I finally find time to get around to it. But ultimately, Braun and Owls both highlight sort of the negative side of this chapter, the inherent critique, the opposite side of the coin, as I said. While on the surface, Lao Tzu is playing up and idolizing this sort of idyllic and minimalist utopia that may seem totally unrealistic, what he's really doing is also harshly critiquing human systems that rely on unhealthy hierarchy and authority and that are based on an unchecked desire for power. Even a checked desire for power can still be incredibly harmful. And so I'd like to share also from J.H. MacDonald's translation here. To me, it reads as sort of a prayer or like a blessing for what this world should really look like. It's not a Christian version, but it's powerful nonetheless, and I don't think he says anything that that goes against the teachings of Christ. I think it's really a great one to end this section with, and then we'll transition, as I promised, to talk about one more thing that's a bit different, sort of a footnote to the episode. I think that last section will help clarify maybe some questions, but for now, let's hear from J.H. MacDonald. Let nations grow smaller and smaller, and people fewer and fewer. Let weapons become rare and superfluous. Let people feel death's gravity again and never wander far from home. Then boat and carriage will sit unused, and shield and sword lie unnoticed. Let people knot ropes for notation again, and never need anything more. Let them find pleasure in their food and beauty in their clothes, peace in their homes and joy in their ancestral ways. The people in neighboring nations will look across to each other, their chickens and dogs calling back and forth, and yet they'll grow old and die without bothering to exchange visits. Now, I love McDonald's translation, but also some of the ways he words things highlights what some have viewed as some big problems with this chapter. And so to close it out, again, I want to read just from a couple authors that unintentionally enter into a really great dialogue about this. First, we have Stefan Stenod, who takes actually a very critical stance towards this chapter. And then I'll read from Derek Lynn's commentary, which actually responds exactly to what Stenod says, and maybe what some of you were thinking when you first heard this, which is sort of a common, well, he says it's a common misconception. So I'll just take a couple minutes, I'll just read from those two. I don't need to add my own commentary here, and then we'll wrap up the episode. So Stenod wrote, "I have some problems with this chapter. It describes what Lao Tzu regards as a dream society, but I find it kind of boring. No travel, no visions, no aspirations, and no curiosity. Nothing but the routine of everyday life. It's certainly peaceful and secure, but isn't it also dull? Not to Lao Tzu, evidently. He praises this life, which could be described with his favorite image of the uncarved block of wood. We would call it rustic. People have boats and carriages, but no longing to use them for exploring other parts of the world. They see the neighboring village and they hear sounds from there, but they don't bother walking the short distance to visit and get to know its inhabitants. What kind of life is that? What kind of peace and security is that? To me, it seems like sleep, and a dreamless one at that." Derek Lynn clarifies what seems to be a very valid critique here from Stenod. He wrote, "The last line is often misunderstood. Some think that it means people in this land do not visit one another. And this is not quite right, because Tao cultivators are hardly antisocial. When we take the meaning of the entire chapter into consideration, it becomes clear that the last line really means people do not visit trouble upon one another. In this ideal place, petty games of tit for tat simply do not exist." And lastly, Stefan Stenod continues in his commentary, which I think does offer a valid critique, or at least sort of something to balance when we consider this chapter as sort of a description of the ideal life. He says, "Lao Tzu is tired of the spectacular and the grand. He longs back for the basic qualities of life. That is possible for someone who has experienced the world and gotten enough of it. But for those who are yet to explore it, the simple village life might be closer to a prison than a sanctuary. People who enjoy the simple everyday life are free from anguished longings for what very few can get. They will not be tempted by things they can't reach, and they will not suffer because they have less luxury than the emperor and his dukes and generals. Only, and this is important, only by not longing for something else can you truly enjoy what you have." I'll say that again. Only by not longing for something else can you truly enjoy what you have. Many people have this ability, and there is reason to envy them. If we are pleased with a life of simplicity, nothing can surpass it. Still, I'm not sure I would be satisfied. I also doubt that Lao Tzu, this splendid mind pondering the hidden workings of the universe, would have settled for this if he didn't first go out into the world to explore and understand it. What he describes is not a perfect life for everyone, but a perfect retirement plan. The human being is not able to settle for steady peace and quiet until after having experienced at least one adventure. I'll say that again. The human being is not able to settle for steady peace and quiet until after having experienced at least one adventure. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. I hope it gave you a lot to think about. It is hard for me to believe that as I've now rounded the corner, I have one episode left to prepare until we finish the Tao Te Ching, all 81 chapters. 2.5 years ago when I started working on this, I knew I was trying to stay committed, but I don't think I really believed I was going to finish and make it this far. So thank you all for listening and supporting me in this journey. If you are interested in supporting the show, I will refer you to the Patreon page, which is a site where you can sign up for a small monthly subscription to help help support me in the work and get an exchange for a few benefits. Subscriptions are anywhere from $2 to $15 a month. You can check that out. There's a link in the show notes. But to be honest, I'm not sure what's coming next. Got a couple more weeks to prepare this final episode. My life is, to be honest with you, kind of a crazy mess, crazy stressful mess right now. I'm doing my best to practice all these principles of Taoism, but I feel like I'm drowning in a lot of things right now, both work-wise and relationally with some issues in my life, in my workplace as well. So I don't know what's coming next. I've had many ideas and many suggestions. If you have any ideas for what you would like to see me do to continue this show, after we finish chapter 81, I'd love to hear them. You can go on over to the blog if you don't have my email directly and click on the contact button and I will get back to you by email directly. I try to get back as quickly as I possibly can. My goal is always usually within 24 hours, but especially right now, that's not always happening. But would love to hear from you. Don't be afraid to reach out. That's all for now. I will keep you posted in the next episode as to what the plans are, or at least what the possible plans are. It's very possible that I could say, you know what, let's just let things rest. We've set out and finished the journey, and maybe in a few months we can consider starting something new together. But for now, let's stop. I don't know. We'll see what happens in the next few weeks. But I appreciate you listening. Appreciate your support. So many of you have been so supportive over these last couple years. The show has had, I mean, it's not a blockbuster, but it's had far more success and an impact than I ever imagined that it would when I came up with that crazy idea and asked my dear friend to design that crazy provocative logo back in December of, man, it must have been December 2019. So anyway, thank you all. As always, and I hope you have a great day, and grace and peace.